Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Doing well, doing great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, once again for embracing your bounce. It is here. Playoffs continue. Some thought it was scary hours. I think it's slander hours now.
Oh, no.
So, nope. Hey, got to get one up early in the game. What's going on with you, Nikias? How are you doing?
Doing pretty well. Recording on a Thursday night. I guess that's what day it is. Very cool. Pretty good. Starting to wind down. Well, we got one second round series out of the paint. Thrown over the top rope. The Heat were able to knock off the Sixers tonight. We'll talk about that in shortly.
Let's give it up real quick. I know we got the show sheet. I usually just rip it up. Let's give it up for Nikias Duncan, who did predict. What was your prediction?
It was Heat and Six.
The hashtag is Big Agenda. Kendrick Perkins, 47 minutes ago. Jimmy Butler is a postseason player. I picked the Heat and Six, and that's exactly what happened. NBA Today will be live from South Beach. Carry the hell on, ..
Woo! Off the top rope early. That's amazing. Yeah, so we're going to have a fun pod tonight, huh? That's very cool. Very cool indeed. At any rate, we will get into Heat Sixes shortly. But first, let's get some news items out of the way. Shout out to the Grizzlies, Zach Kleiman, for winning Executive of the Year. I can speak. He got 16 of the 29 first place votes. He was obviously the winner, but also one of 18 different executives to get a vote for this award, which means there were 12 that did not get a vote. If you're one of the 12, how are you feeling? Are you looking over your shoulder a little bit? Are you feeling the way?
That's hate. That's what it is.
Ah, I see.
They was hating. And you can't really say nothing because, you know, you're still trying to make deals. But, you know, you text a friend. Can you believe this? I mean, think about do we have the full list of the 12?
We have the full list of the 12.
Sam Presti, they said, yo, stop asking me for picks.
Kind of tough.
The Portland conglomerate didn't get one. Sean Marks didn't get one.
Nothing from Utah. The Lakers, surprisingly, had a vote. Not sure why. Big snub, in my opinion. Indiana and Sacramento, despite their all-star and high-level prospect trade midway through the year, neither team had a representative in the voting block. So that was interesting. A no for Washington, a no for Atlanta, a no for Detroit. Are we missing anyone? Oh, no Golden State, which was interesting to me as well. The Knicks conglomerate, CAA, did not get a vote. Kind of tough. Is that all of the 12? No Utah?
Yeah, I think we nailed them all.
I think that's it.
But yeah, no, so salute to Zach for winning that. That's huge. You know, you become one of the only people to do something that Jerry West has done. You've achieved something great, especially at 33, 2 years younger than me, running the game. Salute to him.
Big time.
It is. It's huge. I'd be hot if I was Daryl Morey, though. I land James Harden in the middle of the season. I got as many points as Minnesota. Fam.
This is that's kind of tough. This is this Torian Prince slander. oh, man. Hey, man. He gave a Torian Prince scoring performance in the closeout game. So, I guess. All right. We'll move. Before we once again, before we get into the playoff talk, let's move to the WNBA side really quickly. Some not so fun news so far. Looks like we have an early COVID run in the league right now. Natasha Cloud, Washington Mystics guard, she missed out on Tuesday's win over the Aces because she's in health and safety protocols. Breonna Stewart and Epiphany Prince from Seattle, also in health and safety protocols right now, contributed to their 20-point loss to the Mercury on Wednesday. And we got a bit of a tweet storm from some of the players involved. Natasha Cloud tweeted out, Shout out to the WNBA for flying us commercial during the pandemic and no mask mandate, no Mystics. Breonna Stewart quote tweeted her announcement with fly commercial they say dot, dot, dot. And the weird one was Natalie Williams, the new GM of the Las Vegas Aces. She tweeted out, traveled out with Las Vegas Aces 12 hours ago. Commercial from Vegas to D.C. Let's have a conversation. If it costs $20 million to fly all WNBA teams charter for the season, what 20 millionaires can we get to donate to the cause? And she tagged Elon Musk, LeBron James, Oprah, Beyonce, Delta, and Nike, which is quite the list, first and foremost. Two, it's just odd coming from Natalie because, like, Mark Davis is, who is, like, the owner of the Aces, like, he's already offered to do so. Like, he literally can't. It's a CBA restriction that doesn't allow him to fly the Flyers charter. Also, like, Twitter panhandling for something that could be solved if the CBA was tweaked is not.
I am never participating in Natalie Williams slander. Living legend.
Living legend indeed.
Go like power. The thing is, she said the thing. And you can't say the thing. I think everyone can agree that this needs to be fixed, needs to be addressed.
Should have been fixed yesterday. Yes.
Pretty universally. It's nothing new. Mm-hmm. It's tough because the WNBA has momentum with their product. And they cannot have a self-inflicted wound like this. Right? Natasha Cloud had the quote, right? I'm a shooter now, correct?
Yes.
Immediately didn't play. You can't have those kind of moments. And it's going to be loud. It's going to be outspoken. And unfortunately, a lot of times it feels like bad things have to happen before change can come. The issue is, the flip side is, it's a touchy subject, which is why the tweet was deleted. Paste.
Yes.
The league is working to get the money where it needs to be. And it's not there yet. And if you know, well, a lot of the critique of the league has generally been what? Profitability.
Oh, see, I thought that was rhetorical. I didn't know.
You want to be every time I ask you a question, you think it's a big agenda or it's rhetorical.
Yes. Man,
put that on the, put that on the bingo board. Nikias leaves blank space for a question. I need that on the next one. I'm trying to run two-man game. My man's in the corner like, yo, I thought, hey.
I'm thinking you faking the handoff. I'm sorry.
No, I'm slinging to you screen. But that's they're going to have to keep grinding to get to that point. Now, hopefully, you know, this doesn't have to be a widespread type deal where it hurts the season, hurts teams. You know, player safety is very important. You want everyone to be all right, but
right,
it's a bag deal, and they to be able to do it, it's gonna have to be everyone has to do it.
Yeah, and this is part of what frustrates me about the whole ordeal, is because again, like I referenced Mark Davis a little bit earlier, like he's ready and willing to do it now. Like, the W needs funding overall. I 100% agree with you. But, like, if there are owners already ready to do this, or at the very least are ready to do so for their teams.
For their teams, though.
Yes.
Means there may be some who are saying, hey, man, I don't know about that.
Yeah. Like, I think it's in the CBA because it would be deemed a competitive advantage. So, like, I get it to a point, but also, that should be a criticism of the owner who doesn't do it. It's kind of where I land. Like if it's a competitive advantage for one owner to have be able to fly their team's charter and another one can't, then like I understand it's basic. It's not as simple as it is. But like why are you owning the team if you can't provide this for your players?
I just hope it gets to a better place and they get what they need. Because I think Sue Bird hit it on the head. It's like, not only are they flying, also they are a lot of their eating is also out. Like, mm-hmm. It's just a lot of public stuff during with still a pandemic, which
yeah
makes things interesting. And the W has worked too hard to get this point and have this kind of momentum. And now kind of, I don't want to see it go backwards at all, you know?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I guess, like, it's unfortunate that this is happening, and we both agree, like, they should figure this flight issue out very soon. I guess in terms of, like, the health and safety protocol matter, like, if it's going to happen, I guess it's best that it happens within the first week and a half of the season versus getting hit during a playoff stretch. And something like that really derails a team's run. You don't want that. But again, let's get these ladies the accommodations that they need. They deserve it. This should be settled. This should have been settled a long time ago. Let's get this right. Let's get this right. While we're on the W, what exactly is going on with the Minnesota Lynx right now?
I don't know, but they're trying to figure it out. I'll tell you that much.
Moves are being made. Like, Angel McCautry has agreed to a contract buyout this early. Played 7 minutes in the last outing. Cheryl Reed was asked about it, and it was basically, yeah, we're trying to make runs. We're trying to figure out combinations that help us win. So, .. And it's like, ah, well, if it's here already, that's a bit unfortunate. And I go back to right before the season where there was this big round of waivings from the Lynx to make room for Odyssey Sims to be brought in. And Odyssey Sims is now being waived. And I'm just like, that's early. That's a bit unfortunate. And I'm also watching what Crystal Dangerfield is doing off the bench for Indiana right now. And it's like, huh, you kind of had that in-house if you would have waited for her to come back and kept her on the roster versus doing some shuffling. So this is not great. And they're already, again, they're missing talent still. Not the best start for the Minnesota League.
They run it on the fly. This feels like the most extreme version of we had an idea in our head before the season and we can't get there. So we have to shift. Now, usually it's like the offense didn't work, the lineup didn't work, but it's like, you know, the whole team. No.
Yeah.
Missing too much. It feels like they're like, you know what? This vision that we had, we can't get there. So let's just try and get somewhere. And I don't think they know what the answer is, but they're working to get there.
I will say, I'll actually commend them on that front. Like, as wild as the news wire was today, you know, recording on a Thursday night, it is a little bit refreshing to see a sports team be like, okay, this is not working. We are going to make changes now versus giving it a 10, 12, 15 game run. And now this is what, a 36 game regular season. Now a third of your year is gone and it's, oh, now we need to pivot. And now we need to go 18-4 to close out the year or whatever it is to make a run. Like, I appreciate them pivoting early, but also it's just the optics of it is
not great. It's a lot, but you can't let the early season get away from you in the W. Because we've seen runs. We've also seen where the start is kind of .. So
we shall see. I mean, we just, as you said, we've seen runs. Chicago's guy last season dealt with a ton of injuries to start the year. They were pretty much a 500 club for most of it. They got healthy at the right time and ended up winning a title. I'm not sure if that's in the cards for the Lynx this year, but again, they are making their moves early, trying to correct things while they can. We will see how they rebound moving forward. While we're on W, I would like to talk about the Atlanta Dream for a quick moment. This was slated to be a rebuilding season for them after a year of mayhem within that front office and on the roster last season. There were suspensions. There were suspensions without reasons listed. There was some turnover on the coaching staff multiple times over. There was some front office turnover. And now we get here, and it's very early. It's been a couple of games. But I have enjoyed watching the Dream on the court this year. Ryan Howard is incredible.
Hey, Ryan Howard is electric. The Dream are very fun to watch. She's very fun to watch very early in this season. But please continue.
I don't want to start there. It's two games, of course. She has not seen a closeout that she cares about yet. She does not care about your contest. And I heard it during the broadcast. I was watching the Sparks game a little bit earlier today. And it's like, yeah, she's 6'2 with a shooting stroke like this. Like, you typically don't see wings with this kind of size, with this kind of shooting stroke. And she also has the ball skills to go with it. I will say I'm intrigued to see how teams defend her moving forward, because in the second half of that game, we did see more Jordan Canada on her. We saw them go with guards on her to try to pressure her dribble a little bit. So I want to see how she counters that and how she deals with that kind of ball pressure. But overall, for her to have that size and to not just be able to shoot, but she's moving, she's shooting off movement. She's flying off.
Shoot off movement with ease. And like the on-off ball combo is the dangerous part. But please continue.
Yeah, like I appreciate that kind of skill set from her. She's displaying it this early. And also, shout out to new head coach Tanisha Wright. Like, she is utilizing her well. First couple of possessions of the game, of that Sparks game, is just her running off pin downs and flares. And they're just like, okay, we're going to attack Liz Cambage in a drop, which we should probably talk about that a little bit too. But went right to it. Like, let's get her on the move. Let's create some open looks. Let's get her in the flow early. Like, they did that. And then zooming out with what the Dream are trying to do. They are pushing the pace. They are pushing after makes. They are pushing after misses. It's just, I already enjoy the outline of what this team's going to be. And they're not healthy yet.
No, yeah. If you watch them, anytime there's a make, watch how quickly they outlet the ball. It's out. It's gone. They're getting right into their movement. And as you talk about Howard, the way they blend her kind of fits with their whole team vision as far as being able to use her off ball, running the first that's four, but then also just running her off random pin downs if things break down. And the ball movement they have, the player movement they have, the lineup versatility where you got a lot of people that can drive, you can space the floor, and you kind of have a moving target offensively. That's been the real fun part to me, the driving kick that they have found and the openings. And once that ball starts popping and moving, they're able to make you pay. So being a moving target offensively and then having that kind of anchor where the ball swings to her, it's a wrap. If you need a pick and roll play, you know, I was impressed. You mentioned the first two plays. There was a play early in that first quarter against the Sparks where Ryan Howard came off pick and roll, hesitation to engage, I believe it was Cambage, then kicked it out. Now the ball's rotating. They get a three. Mm-hmm. So the dream have been fun. They've got some pieces.
They've got some pieces. I will be heading down to Atlanta. The Aces are going to be in town on Friday. Have to check that out live. I need to see. Need to see how real this start is for the Dream. Also, just want to see the Aces. But go ahead, make your jokes. It's fine.
None today.
None today. You're good. Just putting it in the holster. So no, like I want to see the vibe of this team, because the other thing is like the home crowd's been packed from what I've seen. It's nice again after the season that the Dream had last year. It's nice to see the fans engaged like this. They just, judging my timeline stuff, very anecdotal, but like they were very excited about the Ryan Howard pick. And based on the first couple of games we've seen from her, like that excitement is more than justified. They already seem to be rallying around her and the kind of personality that she has. Not only is she good, she lets you know about it. I've enjoyed her on defense as well. What did she have? Six stocks in the Dallas Wings game in the opener. She had a nice block against Kennedy Carter in the Sparks game as well. Like, she is going to be special if she stays healthy. Just that kind of mindset on both ends, the versatile skill set, being able to run pick and rolls, being able to shoot off movement, not scared to get downhill either. I'm excited to see how she rounds out the rest of her game. That's what I had on that front.
Oh, yeah. And I definitely want to see what they look like as the season progresses, you know, as more teams are ready, more films out there, but it's been a fun start. Are you finally here to talk about the Mystics? Have you recovered from what they did to the Aces? Or are we just going to keep Euro stepping past them?
Not going to keep Euro stepping past them. They are, along with the Dream, they're the only two undefeated teams left for already. No, I have not recovered from what the Mystics did to the Aces, particularly in the second half of that game. A 24-7 third quarter where the Aces just got their water shut off. And outscored them in the fourth as well.
That Mystics defense was active. The switches were all over. Took the Aces out of every set. and then they had a base behind it. Where we're switching, we're standing, we're helping. You want to drive, you're driving into me, and you want to kick. There's someone right there. Please enjoy the rest of this half.
I will say, like, as a basketball viewer and going back to the game, it was fun to watch how engaged they were and how locked in they were. As someone that wants to see the Aces do well, not having a good time. Not having a good time. Neither did any of their guards. Neither did Asia. If this is what the Mystics are going to defend like, and again, this was without Natasha Cloud, who's also a solid defender in her own right. If they can pressure you like this, erase gaps like this, good luck, because the offense is just going to be insane if they stay healthy. This is a Washington Mystics group. Again, dark horses in the league if they can stay healthy, because the talent's there. The talent is on the roster. It just has to be on the court as well. That's really the only, that's the question mark at this point. But man, they didn't have to do the Aces like that, though. That was kind of wild. Like that, just the third quarter, if you can bottle that up. To see a team that good look that helpless on offense is not normal. And this isn't even the most egregious quarter that they forced an offense into against the Lynx. And again, they're missing a lot of pieces, and they've now had some roster turnover since then. A 23-4 second quarter against the Lynx on Sunday. They can just unravel you. And with the offensive style they had, you can't have them making stops and then also getting out in transition. And now they're moving target offensively, because they have shooting and spacing everywhere, and they have women that can get down. It's just, when they hum, man, they're a dangerous squad.
No, it's going to be tough. They got a team effort. They got an energy they play with. You throw in Elena Deladon being back and what she brings to the half-court arsenal as far as space, like pop, pick and roll, cross screen, down screen. There's only
you
one,
want it.
There's only one Rui in Washington now, folks. I'm sorry.
Sing her praises, because she has brought a tremendous spark.
Please watch. When you watch the Wizards, please watch Rui. The paint touches, the activity, the passing. Not afraid to take a pull-up if it's there. She is fun to watch. She is like the anti-Campazzo for me.
Oh, man. That's got to be like a top eight compliment given on the podcast. We'll let the dunkers figure out the others. Oh, man. But no, Rui's fun. Oh, goodness. Shout out to the Mystics. They deserve the praise. Again, they didn't have to do the Ace like that. All right. That is all I have on that front. Let's get into some playoff talk. We did have a series end. The Miami Heat defeated the Philadelphia Sixers earlier tonight, 99-90, in a game that really wasn't that close either. 32 points from Jimmy Butler, 20 points, 11 rebounds, and 5 assists from Max Strus, because we all had that on our collective bingo cards. Joel Embiid had 20 and 12 in 44 minutes. Not the most efficient outing for him. Tyrese Maxey had 20. And then there was James Harden, who finished the game with 11 points. Not great. Only took 9 shots. Very much not great. And of those 9 shots, 2 of them came in the second half. And the last shot came with, I think, a minute and a half left in the fourth, on a position where it didn't really look like he wanted the ball, to be frank with you. No free throws, 9 assists before turnovers. He played 43 minutes. And so first, Miami deserves all the love you can give them.
That's what we need to talk about. And that's what I'm here to talk about. So we can get to the hashtag big slander here in a moment. Couple things I want to riff on here about this series ender. The defense from the Miami Heat was insane in this game. It's not one that's going to be rewatched because it's an elimination game, so usually those just go right out of there. But that was some team defense. Like, this is the trickiest part about a closeout game, is the team that's up can just go to their bag and decide, hey, we're going to throw everything on the table and you have 48 minutes to figure it out. But think about it. Philadelphia is trying to find a way to get an attack Miami's defense. They found some things. Now Miami throws in some under, some drop. Okay, we got some counters against that. And Miami says, you know what? We're going to throw everything at you. Hey, here's PJ Tucker on James Harden. We're going under that first screen. Let's put Tyler Hero in action. He jumped and trapped you. Didn't see that coming, did you? Oh, you want to get Tobias Harris going? Gonna post up front, double on the catch. Oh, Joel Embiid in the post. Okay, we didn't front him. He caught it. Force him baseline. He spins three guys in his face. Now, I will give Philly credit for. And before I get to that, you want to go empty side pick and roll because we're dropping? You think that's a good idea? We're helping on the roll. Two guys are on Embiid's catch. What are you going to do now? They just took things off the playbook. And whenever Philadelphia adjusted, because in the first half, they actually did adjust. And they were like, you know what? Gabe Vincent, you come here. Come defend James Harden. And they were kind of show recover, and James got to a step back. Then, as you pointed out, Sixers started running pistol to open things up for Maxey because they don't want to switch. And Bam wants to stay with Embiid, so they have some things there. Guess what Miami went to after that? Hey, you guys found a rhythm. Zone. And now in the second half, Joel Embiid is literally staring at three defenders on the perimeter. So he has Bam Adebayo working to front him, not just in the post, but any elbow catch. And then you got Tyler Hero, PJ Tucker, Jimmy Butler, name a person staring at him. Three on the ball. James Harden, three on the ball. Humming. This defense was humming, folks. I want to talk about that more than slander hours, but that's not the most engaging content. I understand. No one wants to talk about that, Steve. Let's get these jokes off. I was more impressed by Miami. And also, shout out to Max Strus. Y'all make fun of me saying the Reggie Jackson 2014 thing, but that's a thing. Like, there is a player that just takes everything that you have prepared for and just ends it. What do you end up, 20 and 10, would you say? Yeah, 20 and 10.
20 points, 11 boards, 5 assists.
And was a primary playmaker for Miami.
He was running pick and roll for him.
Handoffs, two on the ball, hit the roller. Pick and roll, two on the ball, hit the roller. How is Max Strus better at versus two on the ball than Tyler Hero? Who saw that coming? You do all this work and Max Strus comes out the top rope in an elimination game. You're down by 1.5 because Max Strus has 16. What? But that's why it's important. Miami needs one, just one guard to make a team say, we're going to put two on the ball. One guard not named Tyler Hero right now, all due respect. They can get one that's not Tyler, open so much up. But go ahead, get to your Philly rant.
I don't even know if I have a Philly rant. Like, I'm with you. I was more impressed with what Miami was doing than what Philly had going on. Because we knew what they were up against. And then that was added on to with Danny Green suffering that leg injury. I hope he's okay. Because that didn't look good when it happened. And he was immediately ruled out. And we got the Woj tweet saying, like, there's concern about what this injury is going to be. So we'll get that news, I guess, sometime Friday, maybe Saturday, and see what the official diagnosis is. Didn't look great. Danny Green was huge for Philadelphia for this playoff run, really. With the way that he shot threes, relocated, he had to take on a lot more primary assignments defensively because Tyrese Maxey was not available for portions of the Toronto series. And then also, Philly just got to the point where it's like, okay, we just prioritize the spacing that Danny Green provides more than what Matisse does in the starting lineup. Let's stick here. So, hope Danny Green's all right. On the Miami front, I'm glad you brought up Max Strus drawing too, because that was the thing that really caught my eye offensively. Joel Embiid, when he first got back game 3, very deep drop on his first few possessions, trying to find his way. And after those first few possessions, he was playing a little bit higher. It was still a drop, wasn't quite at the level, but pretty high. As the series kept going on, as Miami started gaining more comfort, particularly in game 5, you point this out during our watch party, and in this game 6, Miami was just like, all right, we're going to put our heads down. We're going to drive, and we're going to open up some things. And once the three started falling, and they definitely fell in game 5, Joel Embiid just kept creeping up higher and higher and higher with some of the handoffs and pick and rolls. I was like, okay, this is interesting. We get to game 6, and Max Strus is coming off a handoff. Whether it's Tyrese Maxey trying to slither across screen. Actually, quick shout out to Tyrese Maxey, who did a much better job navigating screens tonight than he had in any points of the series. I guess that's kind of the benefit of a playoff series, seeing the same opponent multiple times. You start to gain the rhythm with that. But if it was Maxey on him, if it was Harris on him, if he had Matisse on a few possessions when he was out there, Joel Embiid is like, it's a full show now. It's an occasional trap now. I'm just like, wait, Max Strus is garnering. Philly might have an issue if Joel Embiid, especially in this physical state, if Joel Embiid feels the need to do this, or if Doc Rivers is instructing him to play higher up, Miami's got you. Because the question all year long, and in this series, particularly in games 3 and 4, when things kind of fell apart, was what is this half-court offense going to look like? Because Embiid came back in game 3, and Miami couldn't force rotations consistently. They couldn't really bend Philadelphia's defense like that. More so in game 3 and game 4, it was a problem, because they did get better in game 4 and still ended up losing. But if you get that, if you're able to force that extra attention, that's when Miami can get to their driving kick. That's when they can get to all the cuts. The post splits hit a little bit harder. If they can get you moving, they have the kind of shooters that can bomb you away. They have guys that can attack closeout. And then if all of that fails, you have this version of Jimmy Butler right now, who has been incredible this entire postseason run. And so that, the way that the offense opened up was pretty surprising to me, but it was a welcome surprise. And you just killed the defense section, so I don't need to rehash all that. Miami's just incredible. For Philly, I more so feel bad for how things ended for them. For Joel Embiid to have his season end this way, to have an MVP caliber season. Nikola Jokic was my pick, and you can go back to the podcast episodes. Like, that's who I picked. But Embiid was incredible all year long. Had to carry an incredible load. And for him to have the injury misfortune that he had in this postseason puts a damper on the way that his season was going. It's just a record scratch for him to be that dominant this year and then have the injury suffered in Toronto. And he's dealing with the thumb. He's dealing with the face now. Now he has to face Miami and come back mid-series. And 70% of Embiid immediately shifted what the series looked like for 2 games. Just a testament to how good he is, how dominant he is. So to have to fight through that just feels unfair to him. And I hope he's able to take this offseason, really get healthy. And I hope the front office is able to put together a more competent roster, add some real depth, particularly on the wings, because this is also why I felt bad for Philly. And I'll save the hard portion for last, I guess. Once Danny Green went down, Miami defended like it was 4-on-5. Pretty much from the moment Danny Green went down. Matisse Thybulle was on the floor. They did not defend him. Shade Milton, bless his heart, because he had a stretch in the third quarter. But when he was on the perimeter, Miami did not care. They had to dust off Korkmaz. He didn't have the 3-ball going. We've talked about Niang in this series. We know he can shoot, but if he isn't, what else are you getting from him? And it just really highlighted this Philly team really isn't deep. They need peak level Embiid. And they also need Tyrese Maxey. They need Tobias Harris. And they need James Harden. And so injuries kind of derailed it, made the lack of depth even more apparent. And then you get the Harden game, where it's just like 9 shot attempts.
I'm going to pause you before you get to your Harden segment.
All right.
Then I'm going to give you the freedom to run the offense, let you run the show. I'm going to go quick on Philadelphia here.
Okay.
It's an odd dynamic because you make the trade to get James Harden, which elevates your ceiling, but you have a short window to figure a lot out with depth concerns. And you end up facing probably the 2 teams that can do the thing that could hurt you the best in Toronto and Miami. Mm-hmm. As far as we can switch, we can help, we can double, we can fly around. And so I thought Philadelphia found some things on the fly on how to attack when teams were switching and how to open things up. I thought what they did to end that Toronto series was brilliant as far as finding the matchups, putting more pressure on them. They couldn't necessarily get there in this Miami series consistently. Joel Embiid had a hell of a year. I wish he had been healthy. it's going to be interesting to see what their next step is, because you found Maxey, you have Harden, Embiid took another step. How do you feel around it? Can you get the shooting? Can you get the two-way lineups? Can you build a small lineup out of this team? What can you do versatility-wise to open things up for what you have now? So that'll be fun to watch. But I will go ahead and clear out and let you talk about Jim.
Good old Jam Har. No, but I honestly don't have that much. I feel like this is setting up like a four-letter segment. And it's not going to be that. I'm just disappointed more than anything. Because 9 shot attempts in 43 minutes is just not, that's not enough. Like, Miami defended him pretty well. And I do want to give him a quick hat tip, because when Philadelphia had to adjust their lineups on the fly post Danny Green injury, it was a lot of James Harden on Jimmy Butler. And I feel like he actually did a pretty decent job on ball. Off ball was a bit of a mess. He lost, guys were able to cut behind him. He did not do a good job of boxing out. So, like, overall, a bad defensive effort for him. But, like, I did appreciate the on-ball effort that he gave against Jimmy Butler when Max stood up against him. So, it wasn't a literal F performance for James Harden. But, like, the lack of aggression was palpable. And I can't ignore the fatigue factor, because he did have to carry a heavier load and see more defensive attention without Embiid early in the series. And, like, that kind of catches up to you. But also, 9 shots, it's hard to get past 9 shot attempts. That's a difficult thing to do.
I'm going to pause you during your rant.
Okay.
Because I believe inside the NBA, that crew, they talked about Joel Embiid needing to be more aggressive, right?
Yes.
Now you're talking about James Harden needing to be more aggressive, right?
Yes.
Your allies. The allied powers. Continue.
I will say there's a slight that actually, I'm just going to leave that one alone. That would derail this portion of the conversation. But James, that's who you complain about in terms of the aggression. Like, you could see the fatigue from Embiid. Like, he's showing high and pick and rolls on one end, and he has a defense that's throwing 2-3 bodies at him. And not that James Harden wasn't also seeing a bunch of defensive attention, but Embiid left it out there. It did transition from a bunch of post-ups to more face-up jumpers. And again, that's just the fatigue. That's the legs kind of giving out on him. Like, he's trying to get back in shape during the season, during the series, basically, because of the injury absence. But you see that. To watch somebody's Harden possessions where it's one pass and stand. Like, that bothers me a little bit. Not even a little bit. That just bothers me. Like, they did run a lot of their offense, particularly in the second half. They did run a lot for Tyrese Maxey, and Maxey was able to get some stuff to go for him. But it's just like, he'd give the ball up, Miami would help, and there would be like a pocket for him to relocate into. I'm just looking at stuff like that. Or it's like, at least make yourself a threat. Because he was asked about this post game. He was like, hey, can you explain why you only took 2 shots in the second half? And he said something to the effect of, oh, we were running our offense, the ball didn't make it back to me. And it's like, okay. Like, if Maxey had the hot hand, if Tobias Harris had some favorable matchups on post-ups, Shake Milton had a stretch, like, it's not completely bad that other guys got touches, but what were you doing when they got those touches? And those were the kind of things that were bothering me more so than the shot total. And the shot total is problematic in and of itself for me. But you can't have that and also just a lack of effort. Like, it just didn't seem like he was trying to really put an imprint on things. Like, I'm fine with it. Let's run a high pick and roll, get downhill, make the kick. Someone else makes the play from there. Like, okay, you're not going to get your shot attempts, but like, you pressured the rim. It was a lot of walk past half court, kicking to Maxey coming off the screen and stand 28 feet from the basket. Like, at least try to put your imprint on the game. it just feeds into all of the actual slander that he gets. And that's unfortunate for him. I still think he's a great player. I still believe, like, an offseason where he can really work on this hamstring, really get that fixed, will help some of the Bears come back. I think we'll see it. We should see a healthier and better version of James Harden next season. But also, like, man, it would have been nice to see a little bit more.
Nah, I spent the same energy with the Phoenix.
It's happening. Because we are recording during the game
six. It's 70-50, Dallas.
Ooh, we're about to get a game seven, huh?
And Chris Paul's 2-for-4. So I expect the energy to be kept at the exact same Ooh. Level, considering Chris Paul, I believe, has single-digit shot attempts in the last four games.
That's fair. We will review the film and we'll come back to it.
Just throwing it out there. I will not do the James Harden defense. What I will say is I thought he had stretches where he tried to attack. I think the issue is he didn't have his fastball. I think he knew it. So we talked about the burst. We saw the burst when he first got to Philly. We saw it mix in. Then these playoffs gave him some different matchups. Teams more locked in, trying to dissuade the drive. Didn't necessarily have the same burst. Teams aren't giving you the switch. They're mixing up your coverages. You also have the Embiid force, and he's getting a lot of touches. You have Maxey to get going. So it's a different fit, different feel. I'm interested to see what he looks like when he's healthy, that hamstring gets back right, and then what he takes from this season going forward. Because the biggest thing is, as he progresses, I mean, you can say what you want. Still a pressure point. That's proven in that Toronto series. Still a playmaker. Still score. Still a great player. What's the curveball going to be for him that helps him not have to use that fastball but still be effective? So the step back was the cheat code to the drive and finish, to the drive and kick, to the drive and draw fouls. That whole ensemble created, what do you do? Drive isn't as strong. That takes him off the menu. It can't just be step backs. And pick and roll, teams are going to give you like a little bit of a buffet to where we're dropping. So come meet us at the rim, or we're switching. So go ahead and do the step back. Is it going to be the mid-range step back? Is it going to be him having to move around to different angles on the court? Get to pick and roll in different spots? What's the evolution going to be? That's where my mind goes more than anything else. So, you know, I never argue people's opinion. But it'll be interesting to see how that develops. I think they found something. They got a heck of a duo between those two. It's going to be hard to guard them. Mm-hmm. But I want to see what it looks like after being in a new spot, knowing what you're going to do and how you improve going forward.
He's going to have to approach the summer the right way. And to your point, I think he's going to have to figure something out in the intermediate area. I think that's where the counter is really going to come for him. Whether that's regaining the floater, because that efficiency kind of nosedive in Philadelphia. Whether it's getting the floater back to an acceptable level. Whether, to your point, is it the mid-range step back? Is it just mid-range jumpers, period? Because if he's able to, he has the touch, obviously. He has the footwork, but he can do it. May have to recommit to adding it and making it a significant portion of his game. But if that's something that he can get back to, like, that should open up more for him, like 15 feet in. That should make those drops a little bit more dangerous for defenses to run. Like, okay, well, if he's going to flow around a mid-range area like here, maybe let me take a step up. That's going to open up more lobs for him. Teams might have to show a little bit more help to the rollers. That's going to open up more kicks for him. Maybe that opens things back up for Philadelphia, provided they you're going to have Maxey back. You're probably going to have Tobias Harris back, unless they find a taker for him. I'm not sure what that's going to look like this summer. I don't know. I'm not sourced. But I think that's where it kind of has to be for him, like on the court. I think it's getting something in that like 8 to 18 foot.
Or he gets healthy, has a full off season, and the drive's back, and this whole conversation doesn't make any sense.
Also on the table. Could happen, but get well soon, Joel Embiid. Get well soon, James Harden. Get well soon, Danny Green. Heck of a season for Tyrese Maxey. Very proud of the second half of the year for Tobias Harris. I cannot say that enough. The fight that he gave defensively, the decisiveness that he played with offensively, he deserves his flowers. Matisse Thybulle has to come back with something on offense. He can't afford for teams to literally ignore him. Like, he needs to get to the we're going to help off him portion, not the we are not guarding him. Because you mentioned some of the empty corner pick and rolls Miami ran. Like, it was Philly emptying a corner. It's Max Strus walking to the other side of the court, and you would have you would have Matisse Thybulle and Tobias Harris on the other side. And it's like, okay, we're just going to cover Max. We're going to cover Harris.
The discouraging part of this for Thybulle is he had actually found a lot during the regular season, and all of that got derailed. Like, every single bit of it. Didn't play with much confidence. Didn't have the same pizzazz cutting-wise. Like, he had found ways to be a threat. Cutting on post-ups, cutting on pick and roll, being a screener at times, knocking down a couple shots, attacking in transition. And none of that was present. That's where I get discouraged with it. It's like, all right, it's one thing to not perform well. That happens. It's another for what you did to just now be off the table and you're at the dunker spot. And that's it. Seen that
before?
And it's like, well, the whole point of you doing this was because you could do more than, okay.
Yeah.
Glenn, you mentioned everyone but Glenn.
Well, he, you know, he had a lot thrown on his plate this season, as he would tell you. And I think overall, he did a solid job with what he was given. I have my complaints with some of the lineup stuff, as we've spoken about on the podcast, on the timeline. But I think overall, like, you've talked about the adjustments that he made during the Toronto series, particularly the closeout game. He did different things in this Miami series as well. Like, I think once you got to game 5 and 6, it turned into Miami playing better and shooting better. And also with that happening, it also kind of exposed, okay, Philadelphia does have the top-end talent, but the top-end talent is hampered, and the depth behind the top-end talent, not great. And so you talk about, like, Matisse Thybulle just having things taken off the table. Like, the opposite side of this is, like, George Niang just did not perform. And so you had, it was a lot of plug and play there. So, again, overall, like, I commend the job that Doc did this season. We shall see what the offseason is going to be like for him, too, because his name's been floated in different places. So we'll see if he's...
Where's it been floated?
Austin, the L.A. hat. So,
there's a danger somewhere, but I don't want to get to it. It's fine. Man, do you want to talk about your Bucks or no, nah, man? You really... Yeah, I was just...
We can put a bow on it. It's fine. The Bucks winning game 5 is... I guess you zoom out, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, the Bucks can win a tough game. But the way that they snatched it, it was 93-79 in the fourth quarter. Boston had the game in hand. They had Milwaukee's defense on the ropes. They were figuring things out against Milwaukee's drop. If they involved Bobby Portis in action, they would get 2 on the ball, and they were able to pass out, drive into, and then kick out of that. When Milwaukee went to switching with some of their smaller units, Boston was doing a solid job, especially with their more spaced out lineup. They were picking out mismatches, abusing it, forcing Milwaukee to help, or getting easy shots. These are things that were happening within the first three quarters and some change of this game. And then it jazz music stops.
But pause you there.
All right.
Because I want to zoom it out.
Okay.
I want to zoom it out just a little bit, just a smidge. Because to me, it's such a larger point about the playoffs and how much you really just have to keep executing and keep doing the work that got you the success. Like, it's different. Like, if you're the better team, sometimes you can handle a punch that a team throws at you, figure it out, and then get back to what you do. But in a series, a lot of the times you figure something out and then you have to keep doing that. Like, it doesn't mean you're all the way back and, oh, we can just go out there and hoop now. No. You got there for a reason. You have to keep doing that. Because if you don't do that, you're going to be back in the same boat you were. And to your point, as Boston was finding things before that, that start of the second half, it reminded me of that. I was like, whoa, Boston's kind of leaning into a little bit too much of what they did. But then, as you talked about, they found a lot of stuff. Like, you mentioned how they did to drop. If game four was the pop game, game five was the pocket pass game. But the pocket pass was open. Short roll, we're going to get what we want. And I was like, uh-oh. Milwaukee's drop is going to get hurt like that, and they're going to be in rotation. That's not good. Then they went small, as you stated. And Grayson Allen, buddy, got an NWO beatdown.
He was not having a good time.
Trash is being thrown everywhere. When Peyton Pritchard is saying, hey, yo, come here, let's have a conversation. And the weird part is, if you think about the whole concept of the series, Boston has been trying to figure out enough offensively just to either get Milwaukee to react or survive. And Milwaukee went small, and Boston finally felt like they were playing loose. Easy decisions, quick, flowing, ISOs, but attacking. Attack mindset, getting buckets, getting basket. Played that lineup right off the floor. It wasn't Grayson Allen, it was George Hill. What was interesting was Bobby Portis. Once Milwaukee started switching Bobby Portis, and I think they did it in the first half, and Tatum looked at him for 5 seconds and took a three. And that intrigued me. Because Bobby Portis holding up defensively is massive for Milwaukee. Especially in this series, where during this game, I was literally trying to figure out what on earth is Milwaukee's best lineup. That's where it had gotten for Milwaukee. They had Giannis hard hedge
on Derek White.
That, I thought it was over once I saw that. I was like, huh? This man has been in the deepest of drops. Barely a switch. And now he's showing like it's 2007? But the issue for Boston is they leaned a little bit too much into the matchup hunting. Tempo went down.
That's the one.
The matchup hunting that they had going that kind of freed things up turned into that's all we're doing. And Pat held up. Bobby held up. And those were the two you were attacking. And you were attacking them late in the clock. So your matchup hunting turned into prevent offense. I'm not the biggest football person, but I know if you go to prevent defense a little too quick, it doesn't work, right? In basketball, when you go to prevent offense too quick, it never works. You forget how to play basketball, and now you try and play afterwards, and you look terrible. It's an unwritten rule.
We'll allow it.
Oh, but nah. And I thought they had the right idea, but they just did it too late in the clock. Like, yeah, you want to attack Bobby Portis one-on-one, but you know what else you could do? Put him in down screen actions. They did it once. I want to say with a minute left, they had Horford screen for Tatum. The whole side was empty. Portis had to make a decision, drew a foul. They didn't do those type of things. You know what I mean? They didn't make Giannis into a navigator. But the Bucks are switching everything. Have Giannis switch and then go into pick and roll. Giannis isn't on the weak side. Bobby's in action. What do you have? Like, they just did, it didn't feel like they explored the options enough and give themselves a chance that way.
Would you say their offense was unseasoned late in the game?
No, it was dry. Mm. It was dry food, lukewarm food. Tough. You know, you heat some food up in the microwave and then you gotta do something or something. Then you come back and take a bite. It's like, ah. It was that. You can put it back in. Nah, fam. The Bucks offense is unseasoned. They came out there swinging that ball around, ran elbow action, 9 cuts, ball movement. Dog, no. It's there. Put it on the chicken.
Just need to do it. Oh, goodness. But no, that's the one. Like, the fact that Bobby Portis was able to hold up offensively gave them the best of both worlds, because now you're able to be a little bit more mobile defensively. And on the offensive end, you are able to spread things out, which opens up drives for Giannis, which opens up, in theory, drives for Jrue Holiday. We will talk about his offensive contribution at some point. It opens up drives for those two. You have shooters everywhere. And the big thing, what killed Boston late, they're able to be small while not being that small. If you have Giannis and Bobby Portis as your front court in your small lineup, you can have some fun on the glass. And Milwaukee was able to do that. And that's kind of the issue with Boston going to this small-ish unit, because they don't have a ton of great rebounders on the roster, period. And if you're downsizing, they're without Robert Williams, who's, if he's not their best rebounder, at the very least, he's their best athlete. You take him out, like, that's an advantage for Milwaukee. They just have to hold up enough defensively to where they can make that an advantage. And so for them to be able to get that, get timely shots from Pat Connaughton, bunch of clutch shots during that fourth quarter run. Bobby Portis, timely offensive rebound. Jrue Holiday was a mess offensively for most of it. Huge what? Three down the stretch.
Huge. Big pull up too in Marcus Smart's face. Wes Matthews' defensive effort as well.
Wes has been fighting all playoffs wrong. And so you get enough of those contributions, and Giannis helped them bring it home. He hit a big three. I'm just like, wait a minute. Heck of a time to knock one down on top of the drives.
You got to put a team away. You got to put a team away. And now we have a very weird dynamic with it's a win or go home situation. Milwaukee's at home. And I mean, we can get to it. It's not like Milwaukee solved the issues. Like, the issues are still there. The offensive process
still messy.
Like, please stop putting Marcus Smart and Al Horford in action together. Like, that's just not a good idea. Can you not do that? The lineups, they got to figure out which defensive coverage is going to work now. That, I mean, you found something to win that game, but they have hit your drop. They have hit your switches. And if they hit this Portis lineup that you threw out there,
you're in trouble.
But the funny part is all they have to do is put together 48 minutes. Mm-hmm. And they escape and they never have to talk about it again. That's the playoffs. You get tested to your limits. You get punched in the mouth. You figure it out. And then whole new series. We get to play basketball again.
And now either one of these teams, if Milwaukee's able to get it done, well, we're getting recording on Thursday. If they're able to get it done tomorrow, or we get to a game 7 and they win it, or Boston gets it done, like, Miami's waiting on. And so if we're talking about offensive process stuff for Milwaukee, we're talking about how Boston's late game process was not very good offensively. You don't want to have those kind of issues going into a series against the Miami Heat with what they've done to Trae Young and that Atlanta offense and what they were able to figure out during the back half of the series against Philadelphia. You want to be playing your best offensive basketball heading into the Eastern Conference Finals. So I'm curious to see what that looks like. Can we talk about Jrue for a moment?
Go ahead. Go ahead. Have a holiday.
I just find myself confused watching him. Because in theory, this is a guy that can get downhill pretty much whenever he wants. He's a solid playmaker. He has a post game if he gets like the Derek White matchup, who's a good defender, but he's just slight. So you maybe to move him there. And there were so many possessions in game five and game four and also game three and game two and some portions of game one, where it's Drew walking up high screen Boston switch tween pull up 19 footer. There's 17 seconds left on the shot clock. Nobody moved. Brother, why?
I'm going to pause you because that has low-key been, well, not that shot, but Drew's bag has been basket made, balls inbounded. Before you know it, Drew's taking a pull-up three and it's gone in. So I'm just going to throw that out there as you just to break it up. But go ahead.
He's hit some big ones. Like, he deserves credit. Again, what, a minute or so left in the game? Like, he's hit some big shots. I don't want to take that from him. But, like, from a process standpoint, it's just like, brother.
But this is the fun part about, like, basketball players, and you're not wrong, but that same mindset is going to have you go through the legs, hezzy, in front of the defensive player of the year and knock and it down.
Yeah.
Like, that's just, you have to live with the results. Like, you have to live with Dylan Brooks on Saturday and Sunday, and you don't know what he's going to do on Monday and Tuesday. It happens. As the kids say, it'd be like that.
It do in fact be like that. I just want him to make life a little bit easier for himself. I don't mind the mindset. He needs to be aggressive. He needs to have the mentality, especially that, as you said, like, that bleeds into the confidence to take the kind of shot that he made over Marcus Smart. The aggression in itself is not the issue. It's just channeling that into better shots so that that aggression has a better chance of being fruitful. I don't mind pull-ups from Drew. It's, why are you taking a pull-up with 19 on the clock with no passes in the possession?
Or we have Daniel Tice on the floor. We get the switch for you, Drew, and you just run into him three times in a row. That's not what you mean?
Yes, that is what. That is all. Like, they need Drew to be aggressive, one. They need Drew to be aggressive because Giannis can't do everything, two. They need Drew to be aggressive because Giannis can't do everything and they don't have Chris Middleton right now. So, three, I do not want Drew Holiday to have a 12-shot game. Unless Milwaukee's up 30, he's only played 26 minutes. That's cool. But, like, in general, you don't want less aggressive Drew. You want Drew to take smarter shots. That's all. He's shooting under 40% from two in this series, and he's not getting to the free throw line. Like, that can't be Drew. Or it shouldn't be Drew. Like, Milwaukee's up in the series, so, like, they've been able to weather it. But, like, in a vacuum, you don't want that to be what your second best player is providing on offense. So I feel like a good chunk of that is just him. Like, he just kind of needs to have a better floor game about himself. But also, Bud, help put your players in position. Like, let's set up more empty corner stuff. So at least the drives or the decisions are simplified for Drew. Like, especially with that small lineup, go empty corner with Giannis. Have Pat Connaughton one pass away. If they switch that, it's a pass to Giannis. Dump it down to him. If they're in a drop, that's a pull-up for Drew, or you get some help from the nail, that's a kick to Pat. Like, simplify it so he doesn't have to try to make 12-point jumpers.
And, you know, keep him out of the dunker spot so he can take advantage of some of those rotations.
That would also be helpful. That would be a thing that would be good for Milwaukee. So heading into game six, where is your confidence level with Boston? Or what are you looking for in that game six for Boston? Is it just playing with a little bit more tempo or offensively, or did something else stand out to you in that game five?
It's again, they're in a tricky spot because they had that game. They did the things they needed to do to win that game. They didn't win that game. And if Milwaukee throws them a curveball, it may not matter. So I felt a lot better about them versus drop than I did before, where I thought it was just going to be trying to do enough to get to the pull up. They actually found a way to get in the paint, but they had those stretches again to start the third quarter where it's like, okay, where's the tempo? Where's the ball movement? Where's the aggression? Are you getting paint touches? So they can mix in the pull ups against drop. They can mix in the ISOs. They can mix in the switches. They have counters to what Milwaukee is throwing at them. Can they pull them at the right time? Can they get Jason Tatum unlocked? Can they also get Jaylen Brown unlocked on the road? Can they get those two playing well together? Are they getting another Al Horford game? Like, as well as they played, they don't have a lot of margin for error. Because if the offense doesn't show up, we can talk about Milwaukee's half-court offense till the cows come home. If Boston's offense doesn't show up, it don't matter. Milwaukee's going to be running in transition, and they'll find a way to live fight another day. So it's going to be on Boston to figure that out again. And then defensively, got to continue to bother Drew. Got to count that lineup. You got to get to Bobby Portis. I think they have to get to Bobby Portis. You got to play Brooke off the court, and you got to play Bobby Portis off the court, or at least make it tough. And you got to find a way in this game to make Milwaukee react again. The issue is just 48 minutes. And if Grayson Allen hits 5 threes,
then what do you do? Just a tough scene. On the Boston front, I haven't seen a tweet yet, so it might not be relevant. But, like, Robert Williams has not played the last two games. Once it was announced that he was out for game 4, Ime Udoka did say, like, he didn't expect it to be a long-term thing. We're just being cautious. He's going to be back in the series. If he's available for game 6, where are you placing him in the rotation? Does he go back to the starting lineup? Is he coming off the bench, just taking the Tice minutes? Like, how does that affect what Boston wants to do, in your opinion?
That's a tough one. It's a tough one because you never know how he feels. I think if he's back, I probably think you start him. And then that limits the Grant Williams exposure a little bit. Now he can come in with a different wave and a different energy. And then you limit the Tice minutes, so you're not giving that mismatch type deal. I think if he's back and ready to go, I think you throw him out there, start him, see what he's got. You know what you have behind it. It would be probably be my thought process.
Okay. No, I can definitely see that case. As my concern with starting him would be what he does to Boston on a spacing front. I think his minutes so far, and again, this is him, he's similar to Embiid. Like, he's playing himself back into game shape because he came into the series following it. Like, him trying to regain his rhythm, especially with the knee injury he's dealing with. Like, that's just a lot. But in his minutes, Boston's offense has just not been very good. And part of that is trying to find a space for him when he's not directly involved in ball screens. And so that's where I'm just like, okay, pivotal game 6, do you want to start Robert Williams and potentially find yourself in an early hole if they can't get things going offensively, or if their tempo is off the start or something like that? Like, that's where I'm kind of like, maybe you bring him off the bench, let him be an energized buddy, see how he does from there. If he comes in, Milwaukee, you know, has like a hybrid second unit in with Giannis leading it. If Giannis beats him up, it's like, okay, well, Robert, thank you for your contributions. Let's relax. We're going to go small for the rest of this. Like, I would rather him be like the second wave versus risking a bad start, if that makes sense.
No, I could understand that. I guess the issue is if you have a bad start and then you throw him in there and then he also has a bad start, then question marks. But either way, you know,
yeah,
you should be a boost for him. How do we feel about Milwaukee's small lineups? Like, just very quickly before we get to the West Coast. Because I got packed up by Bucks Twitter at the trade deadline. And these small lineups, other teams are looking like there's some food on the table. Do we feel like they can find a two-way small lineup with Giannis at the 5?
I mean, you hit on it earlier. Like, I feel like having Bobby on the floor, if he can hold up, like, that's going to be their best version. Because that was kind of the concern, and we've talked about this on earlier episodes of the pod, like, their small lineup now with no P.J. Tucker, it's going to be Giannis and 6'3", 6'3", 6'3", 6'3". And those guys can shoot, and those guys are strong enough to punch above their weight, Drew specifically. But, like, that's small. And when you're facing a wing-heavy team like Boston, that can be a bit of a problem. I think it can. Like, it can work in this series, I feel like. Like, you talked about it earlier. Wes Matthews has done a phenomenal job in this series so far. I guess the question is, if we're going pure small, Giannis at the 5, no Bobby Portis, what do you think their best version of that is right now?
Did you just reverse my question back to me?
Yes.
Wow. I tell you guys, Nikias is an expert Eurostepper, and he just proved it right there.
What do you mean?
Man, I asked what was the best song on lineup. Man said Bobby Portis, then asked me a question. Dog.
No, it's...
Nah, I got you. Giannis, Drew, Wes, Pat. All in on those four.
And then Grayson is where you're just like, eh?
That's the problem. And this is where you had kind of hoped, like in theory, I'm going to sound nuts for saying this. You would have hoped during the season that Jordan Noir would be able to be that.
Mm-hmm.
In theory, but I don't think he holds up.
No, understandable.
And Carter's defense was probably supposed to allow him to be that. The only problem is the size, and especially in this series, because it's switch, post, help, what? I guess that's the issue.
Like, I think my answer for the fifth would be George Hill, but man, Jason Tatum's like, oh, I don't care about that dude. it's and George Hill is coming in. He's missed a large chunk of the playoffs. Like, even he's dealing with that too. But like, in theory, he can shoot. Smart guy off the ball, can move the ball defensively. He is what, 6'3", but has a 6'9" or 6'10" wingspan. Like, in theory, he should be the small that ain't really small guy that can make that work. But it's kind of similar, and I guess we can use this to transition to the West. It's kind of like Luka picking on Cam Johnson. Where it's like, okay, well, this is a wing. Like, Luka's better, but he should be okay physically. And Luka's just like, actually, no. But wait, Cam Payne's on the floor. No, I want Cam Johnson. But wait, this is a second unit with Chris Paul. No, actually, we're going to involve him, and then we're going to get to Cam Johnson. And so I feel like Tatum has just found, like, George Hill, you're supposed to be good defensively. I don't even feel like he's defended Tatum that poorly. It just hasn't mattered. So we'll see. You're just done with Grayson Allen in these late moments.
I mean, he needs to be the guy. He's there to be that guy in that lineup. The issue is the way other teams perceive him on that end of the floor is not going to help him. Like, until he is able to hold up, it's kind of just like the Duncan Robinson corollary, where he was given the effort, but you're coming up here time and time again. Tyler Hero, you're coming up here time and time again. JJ Redick, you're coming up here time. You know what I mean? Once you get that stamp, it's hard to overcome. You got to be really good at the coverage to shake that off. That's a lot of reps. And they don't take much slippage for the switch to be hit. Speaking of switching, just a live update on Phoenix Dallas. Dallas up 94-74. Phoenix is small right now. Torrey Craig is at the five. Dwight Powell switched on to Chris Paul. He caught the pass, swung it, got it back, swung it again, not looking at the rim. A lot of help off Chris Paul as he was spaced behind the three-point line. Anyways, speaking of the West,
stuff.
Desmond Mane.
His best offensive game of the series to this point, 4-6-3. But more importantly, Golden State sent a lot of attention his way. Like, that's naturally a product of Ja Morant not being there. But also, if Desmond Mane is drawing two, flying off a pin down, drawing two, coming off of a handoff, that's going to open up some things for the other Grizzlies. And without Ja Morant, your primary question is, okay, wait, how are they going to bend this defense? How are they going to get Golden State in rotation if they don't have their best player, their best rim pressure guy, their best playmaker, et cetera? And Desmond seemed to be that guy to force extra attention. And then you get into Jaren Jackson knocking down shots, also getting a little busy on the block, also showing some comfort getting downhill. You have Tyus Jones knocking down jumper after jumper after jumper after not shooting particularly well earlier in the series. And Okay, I'm tapping out because Golden State was down 50 plus in this game. They were down 50. You can't have your best player be asked, "Hey, what are you going? What's the game plan tonight?" And your response be, "Whoop that trick," and then lose by. You can't have it.
No, it's not ideal. Now, what I will say is I believe Draymond Green did hit it on the head when it comes to that scenario, and that Memphis is a whole different team without Ja Morant. Now, I'm not going into the debate on, oh, the Grizz are better without. No.
Yeah, don't do that.
That's a different spot. That's the half court spot. You can listen to that on a different podcast platform.
The what?
Don't worry about it. But with Memphis without Ja, the ball is moving more. They have to run more actions. They have to push the tempo. They have to move their bodies. They have to get Desmond Main going because what else are you going to do? You know, Dylan Brooks has to be a different kind of aggressive. And that's an adjustment for a Golden State team that had a playoff game plan based on this team, but a lot of the actions based on Ja and what they ran when he was in there. Now Memphis is a moving target. And the effort's way higher on the other end. Steven Adams adds a different variable where, hey, I'll drop. I'm helping off Draymond. I could get rebounds. I might switch on Steph Curry, which I didn't like so much, but I kind of got it at the end of the day. Switch, they throw it to Draymond in the post, you double, or, you know, hope he has to wear himself down driving. Anyways, that's hard to shift your playoff game plan that quickly on the fly. Now, probably not 50-point loss hard, but yeah. It is an adjustment. And forever and ever and always, if you throw an underdog in Memphis in the FedEx Forum, you're going to get magic. It's just, at some point, it's guaranteed to happen. So shout out to Memphis for that. The question is, can Golden State take care of business? Can they make the adjustment quickly? They're going to have to just, it's going to be defense. They have to set the tone defensively. And I thought the stretch of the game was, I think Draymond had a push. He was setting up one of those jazzy actions that him and Steph Curry do. You know, where Steph's running, Draymond's looking at him, they about to do something. He turned it over, and then Memphis hit a three on the other end. And then it was just an avalanche after that.
There's a lot of turnovers, man. Was it 16 in the first half?
Yeah.
You can't have that. That's, you know, very strong analysis here. But, yeah, you can't turn the ball over that much in one half and expect to win.
Yeah, so I think Golden State needs to just set the tone defensively. Or they can just have a hot shooting night. But don't go back to Memphis. Whatever you do. I know John's not playing. I mean, I might try and play. But you don't want to go back to FedEx.
Yeah, that's not what you want. I will say, like, you say Golden State needs to set the tone defensively. And, like, you're not wrong. They do need to give a much better effort defensively than we saw in game five. I think they need to set the tone offensively. Like, one, don't turn the ball over that much. Like, ball control is very important. You're not going to be able to score if the other team has the ball. Very strong analysis once again. Beyond that, though, if there's one thing that's fair to point out without Ja Morant on the Memphis side, the defense does perk up with no Ja. Like, that takes your smallest guy off the table. That allows them to size up a little bit. They can become a little bit more switchable.
Tyus Jones exists.
He does exist, but like Tyus is short, but he's strong and stocky though. Like Ja is slight. And if you know, I will concede the Tyus Jones point, but I think the overarching thing here is that they are sizing up a little bit more without Ja. Just in terms of the rotation spot, like his minutes have to be filled somewhere. They're going to another wing. And one of the questions, like during the regular season, I asked was like, hey, aside from Steph, like who do we trust on this Golden State team to like consistently break down defense? Like where's the on-ball creation coming from aside from Steph? Jordan Poole was answering that question very strongly, particularly to close out the year. where has he been the last couple of games exactly? You can't have Steph in a shooting slump and also Jordan Poole in a shooting slump, because that now puts more on the plate of Klay Thompson or Andrew Wiggins. And we talked about Klay on the last pod. I don't want to rehash all of that, but like, the self-creation from Klay has not been great. The Andrew Wiggins shot creation, if you're feeding him more on-ball reps, that's very much going to be him or bust, because he's not a playmaker like that. And so if Memphis is able to get Golden State in the mud with these switches and just having more size, and if they're able to win on the glass because they're going to have more size in the front court as well, and that's another place where Stephen Adams can help you, then like that at least gives you the template if you're Memphis. Let's own the interior. Let's swing that back in our favor, because it hasn't been throughout the series. Let's own the interior. Let's muck up the half-court attack. And let's see if we can grind out on the other end. And so I am, like, Golden State should handle business in game 6. We will see on Friday night. But, like, if I'm Memphis, I don't anticipate another 50-point game. But, like, could I see them winning game 6? If they're able to bring this back in the mud, like, yeah, I can see that.
I'm proud of you for finding the template. That's all I have to add. I like that. It's gonna be tough to replicate that. But they do have the template. But again, there's no margin for error. And I don't know that you're gonna get the free giveaways from Golden State that you got last time. So it's gonna be interesting. A great effort from Memphis. Do you want to talk about Chris Paul?
Does Chris Paul want to talk about Chris Paul? This ain't great. Again, we're recording during the game 6 right now. So I look back up at television, 7 minutes left. Dallas is up 17 right now. It's looking like, barring some kind of meltdown, we're going to have a game 7.
Well, quickly, I'll say Phoenix in this game with 7 minutes left in the game, down 17. 28 made field goals, 16 assists, 17 turnovers. And Chris Paul has 2 more field goal attempts than Landry Shamet.
Not ideal. Also, ESPN just showed a graphic. Chris Paul had 28 points in game 2. Chris Paul has scored 22 points in the last 3 games. So, probably need a little bit more from the point guard. Not ideal for him to be this quiet offensively from a scoring perspective.
Give him your takeaways from the last game, because Phoenix found some things. Here's Dallas has clapped back. Looks like the story of the series is clear. What did you see?
I would say for Phoenix, particularly in the third quarter when they really blew things open, like they were able to find a little bit more space in the half court. The Chris Paul pick and rolls have been kind of been my focus over the last few games, with Dallas getting back into the series with their wins in game 3 and game 4. They were mucked things up in game 5 before it blew open. And I'm just looking at, okay, what is the design here? Because if Chris Paul is just missing shots, or if Dallas is defending well and forcing turnovers, which we've seen both of that, then like, all right, cool. But like, what does Phoenix offense look like? Because that's where they get into their good stuff. And I'm looking at high pick and roll with DeAndre Ayton, Jay Crowder one pass away above the break. And it's like, Jay Crowder is a very streaky shooter. He will have a 2-week stretch where he shoots 48% from 3. He'll follow that up with a stretch where he shoots 31% from 3. The volumes will stay static. Like, this is who Jay Crowder is. Defenses defend him like a guy that shoots 33% from 3. Like, they will help off of him. They will muck things up, and if Jay Crowder hits 6 threes in the game, you tip your cap. That's who he is. They don't defend Devin Booker like that. They don't defend Landry Shamet like that. They don't defend Cam Johnson like that. So if you want to open up some space for Chris Paul, who is seeing size thrown on him, hello Reggie Bullock, who is seeing more switches, hello Maxi Kleber.
Not just Maxi Kleber. They were switching Dave Burt on Chris Paul.
Also Dave Burt. But like, if facing a team that is willing to throw size on you and also switch against you, you might want to help Chris out a little bit with some design, because this is not New Orleans should have won MVP during the 2007-2008 season, Chris Paul, where he can get downhill against you. you need to open some things up. So like having a guy who teams aren't defending like that one pass away just allows that guy to help down at the nail. Chris Paul can't get to the elbow, or if he can, it's going to be highly contested. Make life easy. And so in the second half, you saw more of Devin Booker one pass away. You saw more of Cam Johnson one pass away. You saw more of Mikal Bridges screening for Chris Paul. You saw more of Jay Crowder screening for Chris Paul. And I was like, okay, this is how you're going to open it up. Now you're able to move Dallas's defense a little bit. Now you're able to get into more kicks, more threes. If Dallas is switching smaller guys on DeAndre Ayton, now you're starting to see him perk up a little bit offensively because, ooh, buddy, during game 3 of game 4, he was starting to justify Robert Sarver a little bit. And it's like, okay, these are the kind of lapses offensively where it's like, okay, maybe we don't want to give him the max. I still think he should get that. But like with some of the performances, some of the catches, and you had a video on your thread where he slipped the screen, caught the ball. Instead of going with it strong, he spun into help and it turned into a tougher shot. And it's like, okay, if DeAndre Ayton is doing that again, yeah, I'd be a little worried about giving him a full max too. But the floor opened up a little bit and we got the Avalanche for Phoenix. I don't know what's happening in this game 6 yet. All I've seen is the score. So I would imagine Dallas is countered in some way. I'm going to get back to that. I'll have my thoughts on the timeline. But that's what stood out to me in that game 5. It looked like Phoenix had found some answers.
I'll have my thoughts on the timeline. I'm about to be mad silent about this game. Not going to hear a peep. Not going to hear a peep about this game until Sunday. I thought Phoenix found a lot in that game, but I think the story is obviously, can they continue to defend Dallas? Can they protect Chris Paul? Can they handle the adjustments Dallas has tried to make? Because they've made their adjustments, but Chris Paul is going to be the guy they attack, especially if it's a one-game scenario. How do they handle that? And all it takes is one game from Luka. Mm-hmm. The template's there. And yes, you could live with the Luka scoring game, maybe that you got with game 1 then. But win or go home, math changes a little bit. And I'm interested to see what happened in this one. Because we've seen both teams kind of put their will on this game. Phoenix had some incredible team defense in their home win. But Dallas has responded. Dallas is resilient. They always find a way. Devin Booker was incredible in that game.
So many tough shots.
Also, you're talking about process. Man, Phoenix really just let Dave Burt just stand on the weak side.
Yeah, not the best. Not the best.
And like that's the crazy part about that game 5 is Dallas did a lot of good things and looked up and they were tied and then losing and then the game was over. So I mean, there's little things that Dallas can hit pressure point wise against Phoenix, Ayton against the Pop. Ayton still has confidence. Chris Paul, what kind of mindset is he going to come out with? So I'm intrigued. That goes to 7, which it looks like it's going. Oh, yeah. Devin Booker and Chris Paul both out of the game. So, see you Sunday, folks.
Here we go. 4 assists, 5 turnovers. 4 made field goals, 5 turnovers for Chris Paul. Not great. Not great at all. To the mindset point, I hope it's a more aggressive one than we've seen.
No, go ahead. Let's hit that same ISO. Let's go.
No, like, I just want better for Chris Paul, man. He's got to be better. Got to be able to get to his spots. Again, like I pointed out, there are some design things that can help him get to those spots, but also he can't be passing up shots. Even if he does get Maxi Kleber or Dave Burt switched on to him, like he should be able to make those guys pay. They can't all be sidestep jumpers. Like, got to put the pressure on the rim. And defensively, it's not an effort issue, but like Dallas has pinpointed him as one of the guys they want to go get after. Target him with off-ball actions, target him on ball. Lucas posted him up. And that's really the intrigue for me with Phoenix defensively for the first time in a long time. Like, this is the most uneven I've seen them defensively from, like, a health standpoint. They came into the series with a game plan. We're going to give a switch, show some help, rotate from there. Luka and the shooters made that untenable. They loosened up the help. Luka made that untenable. We've seen some zone mixed in. I'm just like, ah, okay, this is different. And so now it just feels like, and I would imagine that's the story of this game six. I haven't seen it yet, but it just feels like they are always searching defensively.
And now, go ahead. I was going to say, what I will say is, I did see a few times Dorian Finney-Smith hounding Chris Paul full court. And then again, Dallas continuing the trend of, hey, we'll switch this area, Chris. So as you come off, we're going to switch to this area. So you can't get to your rhythm pull up. And we're okay with the size that we have against DeAndre Ayton. And that's what I've always been curious about with them. I'm also intrigued. It felt like a lot of bridges on Brunson. And I don't know if that's the best way to do it, just because of his navigation against Luka. So again, uninformed opinions. But trying to give you a little bit more than just box score hunting. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I got you. I guess on that front, like, so would you just not go, oh, what's up?
I'm pausing you here real quick, all right? So you made your Drake Crowder point, which, hey, it's fine. They ran a pick and roll. Devin Booker was on the wing, but the help still came off Drake Crowder.
Tough.
Some of that's just Dallas' scheme. They're going to sell out on that role if they don't switch. I want to watch this game, but it's fine. It's late.
Sorry to keep you holding up, sir. I guess, so would you just not go with bridges on Brunson?
No, I mean, I get the concept. You want to not get him going, let him get going. Allows the closeouts to be different. Especially when Dallas got to the point where it was kicks to Brunson. Brunson's going to his post-ups, those kind of things. But got to be careful. Got to be more careful.
I guess just kind of visualizing, if you're going with bridges on Brunson, then I would imagine that's Jay Crowder and Luka. And so if they want to go Luka Powell pick and roll, like, you could, that's a cleaner switch from like a physical standpoint. Which I guess if I want to give Ayton a quick hat tip in game five, at the very least, like, he looked pretty solid against Luka in space, especially in that second half. So like, they trust him out there. But man, they can always just be like, all right, cool. Bridges on Brunson. We got Jay Crowder. Hey, Reggie Bullock, can you come set a screen for me, please? And then it's Chris Paul. And then it's the same thing. Like, are we just going to let him die out there? Or are we going to send some help and go from there? And I guess on that front, like, maybe that's where... I don't know. Like, it's just interesting, I guess, where Bridges is as a helper. Like, maybe that becomes a little bit different if he's on Brunson versus, like, I
think Bridges committed to full-time elbow help, but that's okay. Got a question for you, though. Just going to Euro step.
All right.
Better season, James Harden or Kyrie Irving?
Oh, God. I think it's Harden, I think. Yeah, I go Harden. I think just being out there for more games kind of gives him the edge, if nothing else.
You gave it to him by default. Okay, all right.
I mean, he was on the floor.
All right.
He played second round minutes.
All right, don't get cursed out on Twitch.
they look like fun streams for what it's worth. But, all right, well, that's all I have. I need to see what the heck happened in this game six. Wow. With that being said, thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can find me on Twitter at NakaiasNBA. You can find Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Please join the Dunker Spot community if you have not already. We're doing some fun stuff in there, so get in. Also, very special episode of the Dunker Spot coming next week. So be tuned in, tell your friends about it, and with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Is Rui Machida the next Giannis Antetokounmpo?